Welcome to this special edition of Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Ariana Pelosi. As part of its Between the Lines program, Cancer Network hosted a discussion with Dr. Gregory Riley of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York and Dr. Tarek Mekhail of Advent Health Cancer Institute in Orlando, Florida, to discuss a manuscript on the outcomes and safety of mobocertinib in patients with platinum-pretreated EGFR exon 20 insertion positive metastatic non-small cell lung cancer.
All right, so we have this opportunity to look through this paper, Treatment Outcomes and Safety of Mobocertinib in Platinum Pretreated Patients with EGFR Exon 20 Insertion Positive Metastatic Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. It's quite a mouthful. So we'll jump into this starting at the background here. I think the first point here I'd raise is that this mobocertinib is a oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor targeting EGFR exon 20 insertion. Maybe even stepping back to remind ourselves that EGFR exon 20 insertion is a pretty uncommon event. Probably happens in about 1 or 2% total of people with non-small cell lung cancer. This is, of course, different than the conventional EGFR sensitizing mutations like exon 19 deletion or exon 21 L858R type mutations. So this is a drug that's meant to be for this group of patients. Dr. Mekhail, do you see patients with this particular mutation from time to time?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've participated in that clinical trial, and we probably have perhaps a dozen of patients with exon 20 insertion. And certainly, this is an uncommon mutation. We typically see this mutation in kind of the same kind of patients with see the other sensitizing mutation. But if you don't look for it, you will not find it. And certainly, it is quite uncommon. But when you have a trial like that, you tend to see these patients coming to your site.
A combination of a couple different cohorts in this trial. This is, a protocol that started off at the very beginning, as you'll see at the top there, a phase one dose escalation, 3+3 design. So kind of a standard group of, a standard type of phase one trial. And then when it got to a recommended phase two dose, then you see all these cohorts that were enrolled here, cohort 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And then they enrolled this EXCLAIM cohort, which is patients who had EGFR exon 20 insertions. You see this in the bottom right, EGFR exon 20 insertions who'd had prior treatment. This analysis that we're looking at here, it sort of mixes these cohort one and the EXCLAIM cohort together a little bit. So I think it's worth dwelling on this slide for just a moment. The cohort one is patients who had EGFR exon 20 insertions who were enrolled at the beginning, and 22 of those patients actually had prior platinum. And they're lumped together in one of the cohorts in the study with the 86 patients in this green group, the EXCLAIM group, that had prior platinum. So kind of important to put this together. But this is ultimately a relatively conventional phase two design where everybody got the drug, and then we were able to assess the efficacy by response rate, that sort of thing.
That's cool.
Dr. Mekhail, do you want to take us through these the baseline characteristics in these two cohorts?
Yeah, so really these two cohorts, and I do believe that we have the PPP or prior platinum treated patients, which is 114 patients, and the EXCLAIM cohort. And everybody on the EXCLAIM cohort, 10 patients on the EXCLAIM cohort really did not have prior platinum, but the rest, which are the 86 patients, are really included in the prior platinum cohort. So you'll find similarity in the results that we're gonna talk about. So this is almost an artificial division just because the EXCLAIM had some patients who did not previously receive platinum. And that again emphasizes exactly what I said. It's the typical patients you see sensitizing mutation in. Patients are a little younger than the usual. The median age is around 60, tend to have more females, but certainly abundance of males as well, 34% males. roughly in both cohorts, Asians, black, white. So really the whole geographic areas are well represented, as well as some ethnicities, different ethnicities. The vast majority are adenocarcinomas. There is one squamous cell carcinoma, whether that's a real squamous cell carcinoma or not, we can argue about it, one patient large cell carcinoma. Phenotype is not a genotype. So thinking about females, never smokers, yes, there are abundance of patients on these, but certainly there are males and there are smokers. You see here on the table on the right, former smokers 27 and 25% respectively on the prior platinum or the exclaimed cohort. And these patients, and I think this is important to recognize, the vast majority, obviously on the 114 patients on prior platinum had prior therapy, but really there are patients who had two regimens and there are patients who had more than three regimens. So that some patients are heavily pre-treated population. On the PPP cohort, 100% received platinum-based therapy before. Exclaimed cohort, 10 patients didn't, so it's really 90%. Immunotherapy, some on both arms, many patients had been treated with immunotherapy in the past, 40% roughly. Other TKIs, this is important to recognize, some patients were actually previously treated with different TKIs. Important point that a third of patients had previously had brain metastasis. All patients had to have treated brain metastasis to be included in the study. And I think that's something we also, as we read the paper, we learn a little bit about CNS importance and perhaps activity or lack of for mobocertinib in patients with CNS disease.
Yeah, thank you for taking us through that. And I just to emphasize your point too, that while we see significant proportion of patients were say never smokers, two of the patients or 2% of the patients were current smokers. And so we got a test to find these mutations in all of our patients.
Riley and McHale then reviewed the efficacy data from the trial.
You see a 32% response rate in the prior platinum cohort and a 24% response rate in the exclaim cohort. So certainly reasonable response rates. It clearly stands out that it's not quite what we see with, say, osimertinib in EGFR exon 19 deletion, but certainly better than the standard therapies that we would otherwise have available for our patients. Looking over on the right, you know, one of the endpoints that the FDA seems to like is this duration of response in confirmed responders. And I think if you look at the independent review committee numbers, that's the median in the prior platinum cohort, it's median about 17 and a half months in those patients who respond. I'll say, I don't know, I don't love the duration of response endpoint just because it's not something we can know upfront. You know, when you meet a patient, because you know, when you talk through a treatment with a patient, at least I do, I always say they ask, you know, how long is this drug going to work for me? How is it going to work for me? And for me, the number I focus on is the progression-free survival, because that's the number that you can sort of take of the patient sitting in front of you. What's the median time they're going to be on drug? And from the prior platinum cohort, we see it from the independent review committee assessed PFS at 7.3 months at the median. So, certainly some reasonable time on treatment. And I have a little bit harder time interpreting the overall survival data here. The median overall survival was 24 months. And I think as Dr. McCall highlighted, this group of patients had a range of prior therapies. So it's not as though this is kind of a standard second line cohort. This is a group of people who had up to three prior therapies. So that median overall survival of 24 months is honestly pretty impressive given that prior treatment.
I may commit here, Greg. I actually like the duration of response endpoint because when I talk to my patients, and again, I would have loved to see a 90% or higher response rate, but it isn't the case. But what I tell my patients, well, the point of this drug is if it works, it's going to work well. And perhaps we'll know if it works or not in 6 weeks or 8 weeks. Certainly, we don't have the high response rate you see with OZ in the lesion 19, exactly like you said, and that's unfortunate. But it looks like those in whom the drug works, median duration of response 17.5 months, which is actually very reminiscent of the median duration of response you get with OZ when it works. So the drug is active in whom it's going to work or in whom it's going to be active. So I wanted to comment on that.
Mikhail then led the conversation regarding gastrointestinal toxicities observed with mobocertinib.
It turns out that the only toxicity that had more than 10% for grade 3 is diarrhea, 16% grade 3 diarrhea. And the vast majority of patients had some form of diarrhea, grade 1 to grade 3. And you can actually run your eye along the lines about the other toxicities. You start seeing skin rashes, all grades, 45%. Paronychia, it kind of reminds me of afatinib somehow. And it might be similar. The diarrhea, however, I think it's important, and it's all about being prepared. And I don't know what your strategy is, Greg, about managing diarrhea, and we've got to develop a strategy. I have not personally developed a proactive strategy. I have developed a reactive strategy, and I'm very aggressive on my reaction to the diarrhea. With hydration, with loperamide and symptomatic management, I tend to try not to reduce the dose. At least I try aggressively to manage the diarrhea, because there is some hints on the paper. If you like to read the paper at some point, the safety component of the paper, that the response rate, I mean, this is exploratory and small numbers, but the response rate on patients in whom the dose was reduced was a little numerically lower than if you didn't reduce the dose. 20% versus 31. Can you make anything conclusion out of this small numbers of patients and numbers of patients actually dose reduced? Perhaps I think 25% of patients. So it's a handful, but I tend to try not to reduce the dose. There are other toxicities here that we can go through. The message is this drug needs close monitoring, close management of side effects, mainly diarrhea.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. I think in many ways it does remind us of the old days of EGFR TKIs, and I think most of us developed pretty good skill managing the diarrhea and the rash associated with erlotinib, gefitinib, and afatinib, and probably the diarrhea was most prominent with afatinib. So I think we have to sort of resurrect those skills, and if the nurse that you work with is not quite as familiar with that because she has been around only in the osimertinib era, then you've got to refresh his or her memory about what the management of diarrhea associated with EGFR TKIs is like. But I like you, and have very much a reactive approach, but a aggressively reactive approach. And maybe my proactive component is talking to the patient and talking about the diarrhea and emphasizing the importance of contacting us and emphasizing the importance that we get this managed. I think importantly, what you see here is that there is a relatively narrow window where patients tolerate the drug and it's effective. And so we want to definitely get as much as we can out of the drug. And so if we can add some loperamide and keep the patient on full dose drug, then I think we're in a better place.
Riley then shifted the conversation to what clinical perils can be garnered from the results of this study.
What do you see as some of the key takeaways from this paper?
Well, we have a targeted drug for exon 20 insertion when we didn't have before. And exon 20 insertion is a peculiar disease that has poor outcome with any therapy you give, doesn't respond to prior TKIs. I'm not one that like to give immune checkpoint inhibitors as a frontline for these patients. So I give typically platinum doublet alone. Some of my partners would add an anti-angiogenic. And after that, we really stuck. We didn't have good therapy in the past. We've tried many things. We've tried and certainly supported by some small studies, doubling the dose of OZ or osimertinib. But really now we have a targeted drug, and it's not the only one. Perhaps there are, there's amivantamab, which is also approved. There's another other drugs that are coming on the pipeline. You might comment on them, Greg. But the takeaway message that we have reasonably effective drug, and it's effective in not in the majority, but when it works, it works.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great way to say it. I think the majority of patients do have some response, some benefit, but a significant minority have a great response and a very long duration of benefit. You know, I think that when I think about the therapeutic landscape, really, I agree completely with your approach. I typically, when I meet a patient who has an EGFR exon 20 insertion as initial therapy, we talk about platinum doublet chemotherapy. And typically I'm giving carboplatin pemetrexed for these folks, or maybe cisplatin pemetrexed if they're younger. And then at the second line treatment decision, we really have that decision point between amivantamab and mobocertinib. You know, mobocertinib has the advantage that it's an oral agent, which is nice, but amivantamab has the advantage that it's an IV agent that they don't have to worry about between visits. And so I find myself, you know, talking about both these drugs with patients because, you know, ultimately, you know, neither treatment, it has a curative effect. And so we're probably going to be thinking about the other drug down the road. How do you approach that second line decision around mobocertinib versus amivantamab?
In all honesty, I think the two drugs, when I compare the studies, which is something that we say we shouldn't do, but we do all the time, they are almost equally effective. Perhaps amivantamab have a little higher response rate, at least numerically. The trade-off is shorter median duration of response, and I already told you my bias about the median duration of response. But the message is that both drugs have a side effect profile that needs to be well managed. It's a completely different side effect profile. With the amivantamab, you have the infusion reactions. With mobocertinib, you have the diarrhea. And it all comes to which drug you are more familiar with.
Yeah.
And I'm more familiar with MOBO just because I participated in the study with MOBO. And I can envision that people who participated in the AMI studies probably are more familiar with amivantamab. And I think the patient stuck by to the fact that you will go to a physician which one you are more familiar with. I wish I know the sequencing. But what I know for sure is that drugs might not work on the same patient. So there are patients, so conceptually, the reason I'm optimistic that one drug might work after the other, even though we don't have enough data just yet, because I don't think the 25% that responded to MOBO are the same 30% or so that responded to amivantamab. They are different patients. And we need to figure this out at some point.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think understanding, you know, this is going to require some, you know, quote, real world data to look at, to understand how patients who start with one and go to the other, and then the other patients who start with the other and go to the other. You know, I think looking at those outcomes, seeing if, you know, I think we come from this world of tyrosine kinase inhibitors where we learned a lot about mechanisms of resistance, say back to the erlotinib days. And then we knew we had to go from erlotinib to osimertinib. And we, you know, can't really go from osimertinib to erlotinib. Clearly these drugs have two very different mechanisms of action. So we're not seeing that same sort of thing. So it's going to be interesting to see how this data comes together, but we'll definitely need to get that data over the course of the coming year or two. Well, next we can go on through, how does this paper impact your routine practice, particularly for biomarker testing, therapy selection, and therapy sequencing? I think we've talked a little bit already about therapy selection and sequencing. Maybe we'll talk about biomarker testing next. I'll tell you, biomarker testing is one of those topics that, you know, we could talk about for hours because I feel like everybody has a variety of approaches. But I would say that probably all of us are kind of doing our best to get all the markers that we can get in the fastest time we can get them. Our colleagues here in molecular pathology have a really fabulous platform for next generation sequencing, but the downside is it takes a while. It takes much longer than I'd like. And so here, when we're meeting a patient for the first time, we will typically use a platform that does a rapid test looking for EGFR point mutations and EGFR exon 20 insertions. And I think that's really been helpful for us to understand and identify patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions up front. What do you use to do initial genotyping?
So I love your approach, Greg. We have in-house panel that's 50 gene panel, but it does take 10 business days. We have a reflex testing. So we utilize that a lot. But my approach, however, is if I see a patient in the clinic today that doesn't have a result or a result is pending, I actually add ctDNA. I do liquid biopsy. So I do both unless I, on my desk, a report with an actionable result. So if I have a report from ctDNA from liquid biopsy that says the patient has an ALK fusion, I don't really look for the tissue. I don't order, it's already ordered, but I don't wait for it. And vice versa. If I have a tissue, I don't order the liquid because I have an actionable result. But if I get no result on the 50 gene panel that we have, I actually still do the liquid biopsy because we do believe it's complementary. You said it well. We just need to do everything possible to know as much as we can about the patient.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's always amazing to me, you know, every time we meet a new patient, that sort of race to figure out what mutation they've got or what their PD-L1 status is, so that they can finally figure out what to do for their treatment. It's when there's a delay in that process, it's just a brutal thing for a patient and us as we're trying to figure out what the best thing is for that patient. So what strategies do you use to enhance adherence to tyrosine kinase inhibitors? Talking about side effects, mitigate, manage those. Maybe I'll sort of give my take on this thing. Yeah, I think tyrosine kinase inhibitors, the range of them have such a range of toxicities that we really have to have a very specific education plan for each patient who we're starting on these drugs. And that's what we do. So, you know, in my clinic, I talk through what I think of the common side effects. I have a nurse, a wonderful nurse who works with me, who then talks with the patient about what she sees as the common side effects. And then we're really, you know, I think one of the big steps that we take is really frequent contact in those first couple of weeks when the patient is on drug. That's, I always say the first month on a kinase inhibitor is the hardest because the patient is trying to understand the side effects, trying to understand how to manage it. So we're in relatively close contact during that first month. First week, we give a call. Second week, we see them. Third and fourth week, we give a call as well, because I think it's important to stay in close contact with these people. Because, you know, oftentimes these are people you've known for a while because you've had them on chemotherapy, but you're sort of adjusting things with a new treatment and they need a little bit more close follow-up during that time.
Yeah, I can't add much to what you said. That's the perfect way to do it. So I try to do the same.
Yeah, and I think as we talked about earlier, the kinase inhibitors, in particular with mobocertinib, I think focusing on managing the diarrhea as early as possible is really an important element. All right, and then with regard to next steps, I think we've spent a good time talking about the sequence question, because I think that is important. Where do you see where we're going for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions?
Well, it's actually figuring out number one, if there is a better drug than the other. And actually, I would rather have all the drugs, but know in which group would each work, because they have different mechanisms of action. We talked about MOBO, we talked about Ventimab, there's KEN081. There are other drugs might be coming down the pipeline. And maybe we'll be lucky enough to figure out in whom every one of these classes work. And if we do, maybe we'll move it to the front line in some patients. Combinations is something that I think may happen. I know that the attempt at MOBO combination with chemotherapy was not easy, to say the least. There's a lot of side effects. So I really hope that we will get a drug ultimately that's easier. This is my hope. And until then, we need to work with what we have.
Yeah, you know, I think we've seen with the development of new ALK inhibitors, and we've seen with the development of EGFR inhibitors, that the first generation is not always the best. We have a drug that sort of establishes that this is a group of patients who can benefit from this strategy. But with the second and third generations of these drugs, we can often significantly improve upon both the efficacy and the tolerance. And so I think if we can get more specific EGFR exon 20 insertion drugs, I think it's likely that we're going to be able to have a better therapeutic window, leading to better outcomes for our patients.
And perhaps also with better CNS activity, because on the study that we're talking about, a lot of patients, particularly the patients that had brain metastasis at baseline, brain was the first site of progression of disease in the majority of patients. So I'm not optimistic that MOBO has good CNS activity, and I don't believe AMI either, amivantamab either. So hopefully in the future we'll have a strategy by which we control the brain disease.
Right, completely agree. All right. Well, I think this has been a great conversation around this paper where we saw the efficacy of mobocertinib, an EGFR exon 20 insertion specific tyrosine kinase inhibitor for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion mutant non-small cell lung cancer. We saw reasonable efficacy data and a tolerability that we can certainly manage as medical oncologists. So it's a great conversation, and happy to have this conversation with you.
Thank you, Dr. Riley. That was fun.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review to tell us what you think and what you want to hear more about. The Oncology Peer Review on the Go is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network.